you're tucked in. Cause you are now in bed with Dr. Sue.
Hello, folks. Welcome to In Bed with Dr. Sue. I'm your host, Sue Storm. Coming up, I'll be joined by my guest, Peter Tupper, author of A Lover's Pinch, A Cultural History of Sadomasochism. It is a fascinating subject. I have been reading the book. It is so cool. Peter knows this inside and out, and you're going to be completely enthralled with what you learn here tonight. But first, we've got some things to get to, such as tonight's Adult Business News. And tonight's In Bed Adult Business News is brought to you by RateMyTinyPenis.com, the website where even the little guy gets to show off.
Good day. This is the In Bed Adult Business News for Tuesday, July 24th, 2018. I'm Sue Storm. In a report by Jordan Fisher for Indianapolis ABC affiliate WRTV.com, after arresting their first pimp in over 7 months, Sergeant John Daggy is quoted as saying, "We've been a little bit blinded lately because they shut Backpage down." Daggy said, "I get the reasoning behind it and the ethics behind it, however, it has blinded us. We used to look at Backpage as a trap for human traffickers and pimps. By comparison, IMPD records just for 2018 turned up 48 prostitution reports." Daggy says it also removed one of the best tools police had for finding trafficking cases. Daggy says, "With Backpage, we would subpoena the ads and it would tell a lot of the story. Also, with the ads, we would catch our victim at a hotel room, which would give us a crime scene. There's a ton of evidence at a crime scene. Now, since Backpage is gone, we're getting late reports of them, and we don't have much to go by." On July 19th, U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon heard the Woodhull Freedom Foundation motion for a preliminary injunction against the enforcement of FOSTA based on First and Fifth Amendment violations. Judge Leon said that Woodhull and the Justice Department attorneys may file supplemental pleadings within 10 days of the receipt of their transcripts. He did not disclose when he would rule on the motion for the preliminary injunction, but Adult Business News will keep you informed for further updates regarding this motion. According to the Associated Press, an attention-grabbing pimps campaign for the Nevada legislature has sparked an anti-brothel effort that sex workers fear could spread to parts of the state that allow legal prostitution. I wonder who that attention-grabbing pimp might be. Could it be Trump-loving alleged rapist Dennis Hoff? Why, yes it is. Proponents of the referendum say legal brothels open a door for human trafficking. There's those words again. And could clearly use a dictionary to look up the word legal. Women at the Mustang Ranch say closing legal brothels would actually mean more money for pimps and less safety for prostitutes. Donnie Gilman, son of Mustang Ranch owner Lance Gilman, wants initiative supporters to know that their operation is a clean business. "All the women who work at the Mustang Ranch go through rigorous annual FBI background checks," said Jennifer Barnes, a longtime madam at the brothel. The Mustang Ranch says it employs more than 160 people on a $5.7 million payroll, including $4.3 million paid to workers called courtesans. The brothel also donates about $150,000 every year to senior centers and food banks, while paying more taxes and fees per square foot than any other business in Nevada, their staff said. The supporters of the initiative also have suggested that legalized prostitution harms regional economic development, because clearly we can't have seniors getting together, or God forbid, starving people eating food. Eric Wexler for ABC Action News in Tampa, Florida, reports that Pasco County authorities are sending out a warning. If you're looking to buy sex online, especially from those underage, beware. Intercept bots are the new technology helping the sheriff's office combat online solicitation of sex. Instead of timely sting operations with actual people posing as sex workers, the fake ads actually go to bots who can message back and forth with those soliciting sex. The bots then collect all the information from the sex buyer and send it to law enforcement. Data collected by the bots may have the sex buyer's name, phone number, address, place of employment, and more. Pasco County is the first area in Tampa Bay to use this system as part of the Trafficking Free Zone program. Adult Business News would love to know where these ads are being placed, since the federal government's enactment of FOSTA caused a landslide of advertising sites to shut down. Hard to use those bots if you have nowhere to put them. Clearly, this warning is for those of you using any existing offshore ad sites. Remember, where the ad site is located doesn't protect you. And finally today, from the Get Your Head Out of Your Own Ass department, feminist writer and author of the book The Pimping of Prostitution, Abolishing the Sex Work Myth, Julie Bindle, wrote a piece for thetelegraph.co.uk snubbing the very notion of decriminalizing any form of sex work after traveling the world clearly in pursuit of the most disturbing realms of the sex trade. In this scathing article, Ms. Bindle states, and I quote, "But as the Telegraph reports today, prostitution is not just another job. For every happy prostitute, if one really exists, there are thousands for whom life is sordid and dangerous. Dozens of liaisons a day with down-at-heel strangers in alleyways, parks, or filthy slums. Routine beatings, rapes, and extortion. HIV and syphilis. Cheap spirits and ruinous drugs. These are the grim realities of prostitution, legal or otherwise, the world over. What the liberal analysis ignores is the market. Prostitution is seldom a simple transaction between two consenting adults. It's a racket run for profit. Pimps, brothel owners, gangs, and organized crime syndicates are behind every red light zone from Holbeck to Harar. Their public face is a slightly more respectable lobby of sex profiteers, such as those running escort agencies and strip clubs. They put themselves forward in the media, arguing that the safest way to run prostitution is to legitimize it. Many of the so-called sex worker collectives you see quoted from time to time are funded by this end of the business." End quote. Although Ms. Bindle goes on to somewhat praise the Nordic model of decriminalization, which puts the onus of the transaction on the buyer, it is this general tone of all sex work being evil, underhanded, vile, and filthy that creates these ridiculous laws that only further denigrate and marginalize an already marginalized section of society. Congratulations, Ms. Bindle. It is alleged feminists like yourself who are actually killing more women in the name of female power. So to you, Ms. Bindle, we give the 21 bowl salute. This has been the In Bed Adult Business News, heard only on In Bed with Dr. Sue. For these and more stories, head to FOSTAUpdates.com. Opinions and sarcasm are strictly my own.
Well, come on. Let's see it. Drop your pants. Show us what you have to offer. Isn't that all? At RateMyTinyPenis.com, your pindic will be seen by hundreds of unique visitors each day, all of whom have the ability to rate your tiny member and leave a comment to tell you exactly what they think of it. Can you imagine the humiliation and exposure you'll experience? Well, why just imagine it when you can make it a reality? And the best part? Everything is 100% free. You're welcome, shrimp dick. Now go on over to Rate My Tiny Penis right now and submit us your most pitiful, disgusting dick pic for all the world to see.
Whether you'd like to explore the idea of becoming a phone sex operator or are looking to begin or even expand your independent phone sex business, Lynn of Phone Sex Secrets can help. Phone Sex Secrets offers help and advice for PSOs, including articles on everything from Phone Sex 101 and industry news to marketing to how to build your business. White papers are available for purchase and immediate download. including the exclusive Phone Sex Secrets Caller Survey results, in which nearly 5,000 paying phone sex clients answer questions designed to help you drive your business. Personalized consultation services are also available. Lynn has been featured on Chicago's WGN Radio, ABC's Good Morning America, and elsewhere. She's ready to stand behind you and teach you how to become a phone sex superhero. You can find Lynn on Twitter at Phone Sex Secrets. That's at Phone Sex Secrets. And her website is phonesexsecrets.info. Again, that's phonesexsecrets.info.
This message is for Flirts on Night Flirt, who would like to have exclusively designed listings but don't know how to code. My name is Robin Wildheart, and I've been active on Night Flirt since 2008. Back when I started, I didn't know anyone who did coding for flirts, so I learned how to do it myself. Now I provide a service that does all the coding for you. Just send me a message and I'll explain how easy and affordable it is to get all your coding done for you. Stop worrying and get fast, friendly service, satisfaction guaranteed. You won't make any payments until you're completely satisfied with how your listing looks. Get in touch with Robin Wildheart on Night Flirt, Twitter, or FetLife. The sooner you send me that message, the sooner you'll get that attention-grabbing listing.
And we're back. I have a couple of quick shout-outs before we head to birthdays in the tour report. I want to say hi to Mistress Lilith and Miss Sammy Ray Schwartz and, of course, Mistress Gambit. And somehow, the lovely Samantha Jones was missed on tonight's tour report, but I'm remembering her here by telling you that she is still in the D.C. area right now until Thursday. And to book Sammy, you can email her at exoticsamanthajones@gmail.com. We'll be right back with my guest Peter Tupper right after birthdays and the tour report.
It's time for in-bed birthdays. A big happy birthday goes out to the ever-lovely Kaya. Her birthday is this Thursday, July 26th. And on July 29th, Contessa Zoe Aspasia has her birthday. August the 7th, Belle Darlin has a birthday. And Slave Dean, his birthday is August the 11th. And finally, on August 29th, it's Kazzie Cush's birthday. To see all the birthdays for our listeners, head to InBedWithDrSue.com and click on Birthdays and select the month to see the amazing performers who have birthdays coming up along with their wish list, so you can send a little something to your favorite performers. Also, if you want InBed to promo your birthday and wish list, you can head to InBedWithDrSue.com, click on Birthdays, and it's absolutely free to get your birthday on the show, online, and on Twitter. That's it for InBed Birthdays. This is a tour report on InBed with Dr. Sue for July 24th, 2018. You lucky fuckers get Danielle Squirts and Dixie Lane touring together right now and making their way down to the southern states. July 24th to the 30th, they're in Chicago. July 30th to the 31st, St. Louis. July 31st to August 1st, Indianapolis. August 1st to the 2nd, in Louisville. August 2nd to the 3rd, Nashville. August 3rd to the 4th, they're in Memphis. August 4th to the 7th, they're in New Orleans. August 7th to the 8th, Baton Rouge, and August 9th and 10th, they will be in Houston. For further info on booking either of these two ladies, you can head to Danielle's website, which is daniellesquirts.com, and Dixie's, which is dixiesladies.com. The ever-lovely Mistress Chloe Rose will be joined by Miss Lacey Sedona, July 28th and 29th in Sacramento, California, for double dom sessions and custom clips. For more info, or to book a session or clip, head to either MistressChloeRose.com or TheHumiliationPit.com. Don't forget that Goddess Genevieve will be in St. Petersburg, Florida, August 9th to the 12th at FetCon For tickets to FetCon, head to fetishcon.com. Goddess Vicky will be in the New York, New Jersey area August 2nd to the 5th, and in Philly August 10th to the 12th. She'll be available for real-time Dom sessions and cash meetups. For more info, you can hit up Goddess Vicky on Twitter at GoddessVickyXO or email her at GoddessVickyXO@gmail.com. Riley May will be in Toronto August 8th to the 13th. Duos are available with Pearl Lovely, Karina Lee, Harley Stone, Jane Way, or Vivian Lake. Good Lord, you guys are lucky. Make sure you pre-book. And to do that, go to RileyMae.com. That's RileyMae.com. Exotic Vivian from the Sexy Escort Guide podcast will be in Minneapolis September 6th and 7th. Now would be a good time to get your booking in at ExoticVivian.com before she's booked up. BBW porn star Velma Voodoo will be available for meet and greets in the New Jersey area for Exotica Expo November 2nd to the 4th and in Vegas January 21st to the 28th, 2019. For more info, email Velma at xvelmavoodoox@gmail.com. Speaking of which, Exotica Miami just wrapped up another crazy successful expo this past weekend. The next Exotica Expo is in Edison, New Jersey, November 2nd to the 4th. Tickets are available at exoticaexpo.com. If you have an upcoming tour and would like to include it on InBed's tour report, simply go to InBedWithDrSue.com and click on Contact. And that's the tour report.
I am Siren Reyna. I am a certified and trained hypnotist. This means that I embed all of my recordings with legitimate hypnotic commands. Now, role-playing can be fun, and I enjoy a good story as much as the next person. But if you really want to please me, you will hand me over the keys to your mind and let me do what I do so well. Leave little triggers. Leave little thoughts, leave little hauntings, and make you question your reality. How much of it is you? How much of it is me? How much of it do you want to be me? You want to hand me your mind, don't you? You want to let go, feel free, have fun, and relax. That's right. Hand me the keys to your mind. And let yourself be my hypnotic pet. That's right. Make sure you follow me on Twitter at Siren Reyna. SYRENRAYNA. Enjoy being addicted.
Do you crave to escape from the ordinary? Hi, I'm Goddess Genevieve. I am a sensual erotic hypnotist and very creative cosplayer, and I use my silky, soft, velvety sensual dominance to weave my control all the way into those special spots of your mind where you feel absolutely safe. And incredible. And we are very intrigued. So come on. Kneel before me and let's start your good boy training. And the SirenVoiceGoddess.com. S-I-R-E-N Goddess.com. And let's start your good boy training.
Yo, this is Kate Tukaki and you're in bed with Dr. Sue. Now go and check out my album on SoundCloud. SoundCloud.com/cockygotbars. That's Cocky Got Bars with a Z. Check it out. It's called Spice Cadet. My best album. Just know I got that kick. And I like that dick.
We're back, folks. My guest tonight is an avid researcher and blogger of all things sadomasochism. Since about 2005, He has recently published his book, A Lover's Pinch, A Cultural History of Sadomasochism. Peter is a player and activist in the Vancouver BDSM scene. He has a ton of fantastic stories, and he is about to take us on a journey back through time. Please welcome author Peter Tupper. Hello, Peter.
Hello, how you doing?
Very good, and how are you?
I'm feeling good, sweating a bit in the summer heat, but I'm looking forward to my book launching soon.
That is absolutely. So when does it actually launch?
Well, you can actually, last I checked, you can order it on Amazon right now. Officially, it launches the 31st, and I'm doing a launch party in Vancouver in August.
That's fantastic.
It's not available in Canada yet. Yeah, it's not available in Canada yet, unfortunately.
Well, of course. We're always second best, aren't we?
Well, yeah, I should be used to it by now.
I know, especially with the publishing industry. So give us a bit of background on Peter. Who, like, how long have you been in the scene, and what got you into really researching the background of not only, you know, sadomasochism, but basically domination and submission?
Well, I got involved in around 1994, and that was back when Usenet was the cutting edge of computer technology. It's like a very early form of Reddit.
Mm-hmm.
And around that time, I was in university studying my history degree, and I got interested in kink around the same time. That was when I discovered alt.sex.bondage, which is a discussion forum for kinky people. And that was how I got introduced to, you know, learned about this culture and started learning about books and learning about different, you know, getting involved in the local scene at the time in Vancouver. And so that's when I met what was then called the National Leather Association of Canada, BC chapter, and that went through a few permutations as well. I was involved in, put together a local events webpage out of like hand-coded HTML. And I had to give people this long, long address, web address, because I didn't know how to, you could get your own domain names. I didn't know how that worked. So I did that for a while. I also did like more old-fashioned promotion working as a publicist. So I was doing posters and flyers for different events around town. So I was involved in a bunch of different events through the 90s and into the zeros, I guess you call them. Now there was a parallel thing here, because when I was just early into kink, I was also when I was studying Victorian history, and I read about the relationship of Arthur Munby and Hannah Colwick. And
mm-hmm.
they were a 19th century couple who, a gentleman and his maid of all work. And they both kept diaries, which turned up in historical archives in, I believe, the 50s. And they revealed that they'd been secretly having this consensual master-slave relationship for years. And that was like something I sort of locked onto and remembered, but I didn't like sort of draw any conclusions to it. So I just remembered, there are people who are doing this in the past. I was going backwards a bit and thinking about history and looking into stuff, and I kept realizing I wasn't doing any actual research, but I was curious about this because of my interest in history in general. And I kept realizing, I kept hearing sort of these same hand-wavy explanations that didn't really go very deep, in my opinion.
Right.
So around 2005, I was trying to make a career as a journalist and freelance writer, and I was thinking about, maybe I could write a nonfiction book, and what am I interested in? History of SM and history of kink. And I think that would be an interesting, as far as I knew, nobody had ever explored that in depth. And there's a saying from Toni Morrison who said, you should write the book you would love to read. So I started researching as I went and blogging about it. It was first at beautyanddarkness.blog.ca, and then I switched it to historyofbdsm.com. That produced a lot of interesting, that project led to a lot of interesting things. You know, the research that went into the Lover's Pinch. I presented at some different events and conferences around around North America. I was also hired by Master Taino's Training Academy to edit the nonfiction anthology about consensual master-slave relationships. And last year, it finally led to something like after 12 years of work, actually led to getting an agent and getting a book contract. And you can see the end result of all that work in A Lover's Pinch.
And doing it the real way, not the self-published way, which is awesome. There's a lot of people that are forced to self-publish, but you got an agent. Ooh.
Yeah,
that's cool.
I was considering self-publishing, but I wanted sort of the credibility that would come with regular publishing. I was prepared to do that, but I'm glad it worked out the way it did.
So are we, because I'm telling you, this book is amazing. Let's start off by, if you will, because you've done the background in it. Let's get into the BDSM. There is a lot of back and forth play and has been for many, many years. What exactly, because everyone has their own meaning to the acronym, what exactly is BDSM?
It's a portmanteau acronym combining bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, sadism and masochism, and slave and master and or mistress. So it kind
of it doesn't necessarily have to be the BDSM, meaning that each one is a separate word because we have an amalgamation of so many different words. Is that right?
Yeah, it's like I said, it's sort of a kludge together acronym for covering a sort of a very broad. It tries to be as inclusive as possible of a bunch of different things that like, you know, there are people who do dominant submission and aren't really into the sadomasochistic side. There are people who do S&M play who aren't really into dominance and submission. There are people who, and I tend to view, for example, master-slave relationships or mistress-slave relationships as a subset of dominance and submission. And, I mean, technically you should also work in an F in there for fetish, which sort of overlaps with a lot of this, but it's also not necessarily, you know, there's people who like fetishes who don't have anything to do with dominance and submission or sadism and masochism. So, I mean, I've heard other people call it, you know, whatever it is that we do or kink or what have you. So it's kind of like all kludged together, but it works.
So what area of kink, like, it's kind of weird. You're going through school, you are really getting into history and you're tripping over kink stuff. But what caught your eye personally? Because you obviously are in the scene. Are you in the scene as a dominant? Like, how do you play?
I'm in it as a submissive and as a masochist, and I've always been very attracted to powerful women and capable women, and it wasn't until sort of later on in my life that I sort of like had a name for this. That's when I sort of wandered into alt.sex.bondage and sort of like, oh, that's what it is. That's, you know, here was this ideology I could hook into. And that was what drew me in. And that's what I've been through my kink career. I've been, you know, a male submissive and male masochist. And I've been pretty consistent in that. I've only like topped it like three or four times in my entire career, 20 plus years. So I like, and I think it gives me an interesting perspective, because I think like the heterosexual male submissive is kind of an underexplored quadrant of of kink, and I'm hope that's something I'm actually considering doing a future book about, is looking at the, you know, kink from the heterosexual male submissive perspective.
That's very true, because BDSM, the first thing when you put BDSM, say, into Google Images,
yes,
immediately we are taken to images of female submission, female submission, female submission. And
yep,
that whole end of it, the whole mistress and slave, is quite big. But it does get brushed under the carpet a lot, and it would be nice to see you do something on that, because it really is still leaning towards master-slave, with the female being the slave. It just happens all the time. So it would be great to see that kind of representation, if you can possibly pull that off for us, please.
I'd appreciate it. Well, hopefully in a few years I'll be able to say yes to that. I think a lot of that has to do with that. It's hetero male dominant and hetero female submissive is sort of more compatible with conventional heterosexual scripts. And so that's why.
And
you
puritanical
know,
thinking.
Yeah, and 50 Shades of Grey, that's why I think it was such a commercial success, because it was compatible in that way. So was Secretary, the film. Heterosexual male submission and female dominance is a very different thing that we're much, much less comfortable with. I think that it's just a very difficult thing. And I think that we're so uncomfortable with a man, with a woman who is dominant. And I think we're even more uncomfortable with a man who is submissive, is that they're so going against the grain of what our gender is supposed to be, that we often, like, our reaction tends to be either horror or humor. It's like, you know, a male submissive must be funny. It must be kind of, the only way we can properly respond is with humor. It's like, oh, it's silly, it's not real. And
jump to the guy being a wimp.
Yes.
We automatically jump to, well, obviously he's just weak, not realizing that just because one is sexually submissive doesn't mean that they are submissive throughout the day. You can be perfectly dominant throughout the day, and most of us have to be in order to survive. So, again, it's pigeonholing.
Or that in submission there is strength. There is a
absolutely,
you know, to show the loyalty and show the devotion that you have for another. That is an important thing. And it's really hard for even like movies that talk, even popular movies that show, you know, female dominant, male submissive pairings, like Something Wild or Preaching to the Perverted, there's still this sense of that the man must stop being submissive to be in a couple with the woman. So it's something we're still having a hard time adjusting to. That's why people will buy stuff like Secretary or 50 Shades, because it's less of an adjustment for them.
It's more palatable.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They can make it less of a judgment. It's more familiar. They don't need to make as big a leap to understand it.
Exactly. So when you were doing your research, the first thing I think of, and I'm sure it clearly has to go back further than this, but the first thing I think of is the self-flagellation of some Christian sects. And I would imagine, but it's got to go back way further than that, does it not? I mean, we have to go back basically to the beginning of mankind, because we are a violent society. We are violent little creatures.
Yeah. And that's very close to our capacity for sexuality and our capacity for domination. So that's it's a very, it is there. And it's I think it's complicated because, like, when I was looking at Rome, like mm-hmm. Roman society, when there was, I mentioned the Villa of the Mysteries in mm-hmm. Pompeii, which was part of the excavation in Pompeii. And there's a scene of erotic flagellation in there. There's a scene where a woman is being beaten by another woman with a sort of a cane or a switch. And mm-hmm. we don't, and it's, but it's like, we're not 100% sure of what the context is of this. And the most plausible explanation I've seen is that this is part of a mural that depicts a marriage rite. But like the whole Roman definition of sex, what is sexual and what is not, is very different from ours. It's so alien that to them, the whole idea of homosexual or heterosexual doesn't really make a lot of sense to them. Those aren't meaningful categories to them. So what we're seeing in the Bill of the Mysteries is it sex or is it religion? Are we making a false dichotomy, even trying to distinguish the two in this particular context? And that's what you're talking about in the Christian flagellants. So many of them were pushing for the idea that this was a proper religious ritual and that should be done properly, that could be done, you know, in keeping with God. It's their enemies who said, no, this is physical indulgence. This is the flesh playing tricks on us. That's why we should forbid this. This is not holy. This is not sex. This is just us indulging our baser impulses. And, you know, this confusion and this slippage between two categories keeps turning up over and over again. From the classical period with the early Christians and then through the Middle Ages and up into the Renaissance. It's very, even in Shakespeare, it turns up in Measure for Measure, where Shakespeare makes all these jokes that one of the characters in Measure for Measure, who is supposed to be this very pious and serious judge, is indulging himself through self-flagellation. So it's sort of like it got squeezed out of religion and turned up in sex.
Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't originally basically meant to recreate the 39 lashes, which was the whole basis of the Christian end of it, was that they were putting themselves through that again, right?
Yeah, imitation of Christ was a big part of that, and people would,
right.
you know, meditate on the image of Christ being beaten or the image of Christ on the cross, and you know, people would have these like these little handheld books that they would flip over, and there'd be an image of Christ, you know, that they were supposed to meditate on, and that you know, translated into other Christian martyrologies, and that translated into the whole controversy over flagellation in the early church and whether it should be forbidden or not. So it is something I think so kind of specific to Judeo-Christian thought, or even more specifically Christian thought, that, you know, and so, you know, in the Middle Ages you had all these images of saints and martyrs being beaten and tortured. There was the story of Saint Teresa of Avila, who was a nun who said she had been experienced a transverberation, that an invisible spirit had come to her and thrust a spear into her belly. And this was, you know, people were saying, you know, to us it sounds kind of sexual, but, you know, at the time there were people denying that this should be interpreted sexually. Other people were saying, yes, it should be interpreted sexually. This isn't true piety. It should more be a more cerebral thing. And
Freudian from the sounds of it.
Yeah. And
yeah.
There's an account of someone once made, I believe his name was Bersani. There was a famous life-size statue of St. Teresa being visited by the angel spirit. And, you know, it looks very much like a woman, you know, moaning in ecstasy. And supposedly there was a man, a person, they don't specify the gender, but a person was caught polluting themselves in front of this sculpture. And it's suggesting that there is something, there was this very strange and hazy boundary between sort of religious ecstasy and physical ecstasy. And that sort of gradually got squeezed out of the religious realm and into the sexual realm.
Mm-hmm. At what point in your studies, when you were doing the research, has there ever been a clear delineation as to when we morphed from it being religious into sexual, or have the two always been intertwined in some way, no matter what?
There's always been a dialectic between the two. It moved from one side to the other, but it's something that's hard to completely disentangle, because there's, even now, today, there are people who, you know, are kind of invest spirituality in their kink. They invest their, you know, view it as a form of meditation or as another spiritual experience. So they're like putting religion back into kink, where after centuries of it being sort of drained away. I can give you, there was sort of a hinge point, which was around 1500. And there was a man named Pico de la Mirandola who, wrote a treatise on a man who was who liked to receive flagellation, and he wrote it in a non-religious context. He viewed this as sort of a physiological thing, not a spiritual thing. So he said, he explained it in terms of, so that was like a purely secular explanation of the desire to be flagellated, and that was like a stepping point. But there are, you know, many years later, centuries after that, there were still people like writing and thinking about this weird crossover between religion and kink. Arthur Munby, whom I mentioned earlier, you know, he described Hannah Kolick, her labors and her devotion. He likened her to being like these, you know, religious women of the Middle Ages who would, you know, wear sackcloth and cilices and hair shirts and undertake these, you know, profound labors to mortify the flesh and know God. So it's all about that dialectic between the two.
And there is, when you were discussing, you were just talking about the fact that the whole spirituality thing is sort of seeping its way back into the BDSM scene. And you mentioned in the book something that you found particularly poignant, which was a point when suspension was being done and how this actually had absolutely nothing to do with sex at all. Can you describe that?
Well, certain Native American peoples, mostly of the plains, would perform a ritual called, variously known as the Sun Dance or the Okipa ritual. And this involves having, you know, suspending weights from the body or literally embedded in the flesh, or even like literally hanging from hooks in embedded in the back or the chest. Mm-hmm. And this is a part of an important religious ritual in these for these cultures, and you know, this is an amazing, and one of the things that happened during you know, during when Native peoples were being herded onto reservations, and these rituals were banned. They were not allowed to be, they were expressly forbidden along with other things, and it's only decades later that they sort of like came back as part of both as a part of Native American, modern Native American culture, and as part of sort of the modern primitive movement. But a lot of it actually could be traced back to the movie A Man Called Horse, which was, I believe, 1970. And that movie simulated, they didn't do it for real, but they simulated the suspension from the chest for that movie. And that was apparently a very influential film for the early modern primitive movement and also among Native people. So it's come back. And now, so there are people, like I said, there are people who, some people invest a lot of spirituality in their modern primitive practice. Some of them not only a little bit. Some of them, don't have any sort of like throwing on any organized religion. So it's an example of a religious thing that has been adopted by people who don't necessarily practice that particular religion, but it does include or people who are more secular minded, but do it as sort of a personal ritual.
And I have actually personally seen the suspension done with because it's done a lot within the body modification realm of things, where I've seen the suspension done. It is done literally through the skin, and it is because they're getting a dopamine rush. They're getting that whole Zen moment when they are dangling and when they are feeling that pull. And it just, it sends them again into what would be considered, I guess, on our end of things, would be like a subspace. And again, obviously, this has nothing to do with BDSM. This is strictly within the body modification realm of where everybody's hanging out and whatever. But it's fascinating to see, and it's amazing to talk to the people, obviously not during it, but afterwards, and they are so calm and so serene, and I don't think people understand that as far as masochism is concerned, is that pain can actually be very calming. Can you explain a bit of that?
I would say there is an overlap between the kink world and the BDSM, the kink world and the body modification and modern primitive world. So I think that there's a lot of overlap. There's lots and lots of overlaps here. Everything's sort of messy, but for example, one of the things I've certainly felt the endorphin rush, but it's also I try not to be too reductionist about it and to reduce it purely to an element of brain chemistry. That's certainly one part of it. I would view it as a release. It's like there's also the symbolic element to it, the idea that you're in this intimate, trusting situation with another person, that you're letting them do this to you. There's the symbolic element importance added to different, to different clothing or different contexts. So it's like one of my favorite things is to have to be flogged, and that is gives me a profound sense of excitement, but also a lot of calm afterwards. And it's I feel very calm afterwards. I feel very floaty on the endorphins. I also feel very close to the person who's done that to me, and I want to feel, so I like to talk to them, and that I'm cuddling with them in the aftercare room or, on the aftercare couch and talking to them. And that's how, what it works out for me. And I felt that, for example, I've also recently gotten into temporary piercing, and my record is having 77 needles pushed through my skin, little pinches of my skin. And that is, that gives me, there's an endorphin high from that as well, but it's also a very different experience in that instead of sort of this percussive wham, wham, wham feeling to it, it's more, like a stringed instrument kind of experience, if I'm making myself clear. It's like, a harp music of pain instead of percussion music of pain. And but there's also, don't discount the psychological aspects, because I used to be kind of phobic about needles, and I've gotten over that through this, doing this, through trying. Mm-hmm. So now I don't, and it's, I think it's even sort of physiologically changed me, because when I started doing needle play, I used to bleed a lot and from it. And, you know, that's why you want to be careful doing this kind of thing. You want to, you know, wear gloves and get tested and so forth. But it's also like, you know, more recently when I've done it, I scarcely bleed at all, you know, and like, so I've had, you know, like this, I've had 77 needles put in me. You barely even know the next day, just a few red marks on my skin, and it doesn't look like anything happened to me. So, I think we're all, and that's just me. So other people might be completely different depending on how their skin works and how their physiology works. So it's, I think that like, it's, we're creating these spaces, these ritual spaces where these intense experiences happen. And through the ritual, we have these experience, we have the permission and the conditions to achieve these altered states of consciousness that we can't do otherwise.
Tell us about the story of Jack McGeorge.
Jack McGeorge is, so going back to 2002, this was like just in the, this was Thanksgiving 2002 in the lead up to the war in Iraq after 9/11. Mm-hmm. Jack McGeorge was interviewed by a, there was a guy in the Washington Post newspaper doing articles about the weapons inspectors that were going to go to Iraq and look for weapons of mass destruction. One of them was a retired Marine named Jack McGeorge, who was pointed out was involved in the New England kink scene, Black Rose Group specifically. And this was like literally on the front page of the Washington Post. And people were saying like, you know, wait a second, aha, you know, this is this man, you know, do we want this, or do we want this guy who's been keeping secrets doing this highly, you know, high priority mission? And it turned out that McGeorge has, you know, not been, had, you know, had not been keeping this secret in a long, long time. He had, you know, spoken to, he'd been, you know, working in high security clearance jobs for decades. He'd always told people about his kink life. That had never been a problem before. People were, and so, yeah, but there was all this controversy, and people, you know, some people were treating this as like, of course, this man is illegitimate. We have, this shows that they're not serious. They're, this is not a credible institution to be sent to on this high priority mission. In other words, making sort of jokes like, you know, they have this picture of a guy in full Leatherman outfits walking towards the checkpoint going into Iraq. So it was kind of a cluster. Years and years later, Jack, I was, you know, interested in this. I've been following this case, and I thought that this was like a major, an interesting turning point in the idea of, you know, kinky people as their role in society. Is this like a gay person being denied a government position or a high security position because of their sexuality? You know, or is this not comparable? And I was writing about it on my blog, and I put out an open, just, you know, I said, hey, Mr. McGeorge, if you're listening, reading this, please get in touch with me. I'd love to interview you. And to my surprise, he did.
Oh,
and this
epic.
Is kind of unusual because, yeah, this was years and years after this happened. But he was a very, he'd very rarely spoken to interviewers after this. And he was nice enough to call me. So he told me his whole life story. Well, not his whole life story, but his life story in kink. And he was like talking about how he got started before the modern kink scene as such got started in the 1970s. You know, he was how he was lucky enough to meet other people, how he got involved in the kink world at the time. You know, how the fact that he'd always told people about his kink life. So they always decided, well, I guess it's okay. They can't blackmail you about it. So I guess you're good.
Right.
And so it's, yeah, I always thought it was a fascinating incident of SM sort of turning up in its intersection with politics and intersection with history and how people, I thought a very productive situation in revealing what people think of kink and how and why people either stay in the closet or don't stay in the closet about their kink life.
Yeah.
And I'm very flattered that he was good enough to give me an interview.
What? I'm finding it because I haven't gotten to this point yet. How is it that, I'm dying to know this. How does Uncle Tom's Cabin somehow take us into like regular modern day BDSM pornography?
Okay. So what happens is that Uncle Tom's Cabin was an incredibly popular book published in 1852. And
mm-hmm.
it was an extremely, it was about a slave's, slaves, a slave family in this American South, and they were trying to escape and live with the hardships and separations of slave life. And now I should be careful that Harriet Beecher Stowe, the woman who wrote it, was very careful, she was careful not to write anything terribly salacious in the book.
Mm-hmm.
However, the book turned into this mass multimedia franchise with all these different, illustrated versions. There were card games, there were board games, there were unauthorized live action plays, some of which were very, very strange and included all kinds of things like dance numbers and new characters and boxing matches and giant dogs.
Good Lord.
And so some of these media turned out to be a little sexy. They turned out the whipping scenes became a bit salacious. The women were posed, one scene in the original text, it's like a woman named Prue, who is this ancient alcoholic wretch. And in the illustration for one of the unauthorized editions, she was depicted as this young and shapely woman, stripped bare and in the sort of, boob and butt pose. And this was an unauthorized edition, but it proved to be very popular. And there were other art forms, articles, and, different media that depicted scenes that, put a sort of salacious spin on it. And it was so much so that when Kraft Ebbing or Sigmund Freud were writing about masochism, they often quoted their patients saying that they were, their fantasies were inspired by Uncle Tom's Cabin or Robinson Crusoe or other. So that,
yeah.
that was, that, and I should make it clear that people have a way of reinterpreting things. So when people, when people talk about being aroused by Uncle Tom's Cabin,
mm-hmm.
What's going on in their mind has been like worked, run through. It's like that old game where you played telephone, you'd whisper somebody to the person
right.
next to you, and it worked its way around the circle. And by the time it got back to you, it might be completely unrecognizable. It's a little like that. And so people who have that right frame of mind, that right perspective, were the ones who, saw in this. And you can trace the sort of genealogy of erotic works published in England or America that would have, that would sort of draw on, in the late 19th century, would draw on these familiar tropes of slavery and flagellation and such, and use that as the basis for sexual fantasies.
I'll be damned. So it's almost as if through time they were sexualizing these things.
Yes.
Over time they were taking this, like you said, through this whole post office experience and sexualizing it more and more and more.
That was where it got, people would take, little snippets of things, like, so much of what, before, like, modern kink media, people would, like, scrapbook stuff. They'd, like, a guy would find some little picture of a woman in unusually high heels, and he'd clip it out and squirrel it away with his other collections of things. Like,
right.
The claws, the Irvine and Paula Claw, they did, like, a whole bunch of bondage and photography. They, like, made Betty Page famous. They got started because they were running a business selling movie stills from different, in the 40s. And, they noticed that guys kept coming in and asking for, you got any pictures of women, tied up or anything like that? And they'd be, like, digging them out of old, like, old 1930s, jungle epics and harem girls
right.
and stuff like that. And, the Claws realized, aha, there's a market here. And they started producing and, bondage photos and bondage short films and getting them all out to, and that was like a major part of, one of the major nodes of the early heterosexual kink world. That's where we got Betty Page, and that's how we got this whole iconography of bondage art. And John Willey, famous bondage artist of the period, Eric Stanton, guys like that were tied to these sort of loose networks that that involved the Claws and their business.
So what is the secret history of this entire thing that you have found? What is the most amazing thing that you figured out in all of this research that you've done?
I think it's that people have a very strange way of eroticizing fear because so many
very
of these
true.
Sort of icons of kink are sort of like originally frightening things that we've come to eroticize. So the whole sort of harem image was all about our initial fears of people, of Christians being abducted across the Mediterranean and forced to serve as slaves in North Africa. And, that produced this whole swath of fantasies and images that for centuries. And then it was the American South. People
right.
were, there was this anxiety about women being molested and raped in this. Like one book called The Memoirs of Dolly Morton were all about what would happen if a white woman was treated like a black woman in the slave South. And and that goes on today. Like the whole Nazi exploitation thing, like the Ilsa movies and things like that. That's the same effect. It's like this whole fetishization of this, the images attached to fascism. So that you get movies like The Night Porter and Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS. I mean, Ilsa is really interesting because Diane Thorne did three other movies where she basically played Ilsa, but it's like they're completely different settings. She plays this sort of archetypal character. So first it was Nazis, then it was like oil republics, Middle Eastern oil states and their harems. And then it was a Latin American dictatorship. And then it was Soviet gulags. So it's like, whatever the deviant politics is, we will associate Diane Thorne will play this embodiment of this deviant woman, this evil woman produced by this deviant political system. And the same thing kind of happened with Catholicism. Protestants were making all these pornographic books about what happens to poor women who get stuck in convents and forced to be nuns. that there was a, like the history of Maria Monk in Montreal was you know, this bizarre porno gothic propaganda, and we're still getting this today. Like there's this Mexican magazine called Presidio, which showed had made this sort of a pulpy joke version of the Abu Ghraib pictures with Lindy England, but sort of like, you know, sexed up and looking more shapely and things like that. So it's you know, and I realize that people get very upset about like Nazi exploitation, you know, and I do like a whole chapter specifically discussing, you know, the role of fascism in kink and I think, but I also, and I realize why people get upset about this and why people don't want to, you know, that's a hard limit for them, and I don't blame them for saying that. But I also think it's like this is kind of an inevitable process.
It doesn't, because it pretty much goes on with every single generation, every single political group. This sort of stuff is constantly, like you said, it's being interwoven right from the beginning. It's interwoven now.
Mm-hmm.
It's interwoven with the politics that are happening right now. So it's never, ever going to end. The whole sexual, you know, like, again, I keep going back to interwoven again. It just, sex is always going to be involved in everything. Yeah. And the more, it seems, the more repressed we become, the more it comes to the surface, as right
like,
now.
The whole Pizzagate business.
Yeah.
You know, this ludicrous story that Hillary Clinton and the Democrats were running a child prostitution ring out of a pizza restaurant, out of the basement of a pizza restaurant that doesn't even have a basement. That's straight out of the anti-Catholic playbook of the early 19th century. There were all these stories written about, there were all these, there was this famous book called The Awful Disclosures of Maria Monk, and this woman who turned up in, claimed that she had been held prisoner in a convent in Montreal where she had been taught to be, you know, tortured and taught to be a sex slave for priests, and the children born of this were baptized and then strangled and then disposed of in a lime pit. And, you know, so there's always this temptation to, you know, impute deviant sexuality to your political enemies.
Right, exactly.
And, so Pizzagate is straight out of that. Even to the idea that it's like happening underground, that it's symbolic. It's like it's of the earth. It's of hell. It's out of the light of God. So that's why the sad thing is people believe this enough. That a guy believe this enough to like get a gun and go into this place and thankfully not actually shoot anybody, but it could have been pretty bad.
Slings and arrows. We do that all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just who we are as a society. Would you not agree that we are still a puritanical society right now? We're Puritans. That's a big debate within the whole psychology realm.
I'd say that there is a puritanical axis. There's a puritanical pull on society. That's what I find so peculiar is that, like, I'm looking at this the incels, for example, and these are generally very young men who have been sort of raised post-internet with, like, almost every form of sexuality available for them to see. And they're the most – and some of them are the most sex-negative, most – misogynist guys. They're utterly convinced that they've regressed to a kind of 19th century view of female sexuality, that unless a woman is kept under strict control, they're sluts. So in their fantasies, like the women around them are you know, pulling gangbangs with the football team in high school as soon as they hit 13 or something. That's their what they're imagining. And So this brings them to the point where they're talking about like socially mandated girlfriends or something like that, and it's like they, you know, these guys probably feel comfortable writing The Handmaid's Tale in Gilead.
Yes,
and
there
like
you go.
They,
yes, exactly.
So I think they're so disenchanted with liberal sexuality, with post-feminism sexuality, that they've kind of regressed. They've snapped back to Puritanism, the most patriarchal Puritanism.
Mm-hmm. Hence the reason why that they are constantly the ones that jump on the sex workers for doing what they do. They're usually your online trolls quite a bit too.
It's scary. It's a scary bunch of guys.
They tend to go a little bit overboard in the sense of where you got to kind of be a little bit scared. Because they're not necessarily mentally stable because they've gone into this regressive state. And it's a very angry state, and it's not healthy.
Yeah, I mean, you got like Elliot Rodger. You got that guy who was with the van attack in Toronto a few years ago. Like this. Please tell me that shooting in Toronto a couple of days ago that had nothing to do with that. Please tell me that had nothing to do with that. I don't know.
I'm hoping not. It looks as though it is probably just a case of mental illness, straight up psychosis, because that's what they've been saying. He has been dealing with literal psychosis, not just depression. So he's been dealing with that all his life. Anything could tip that over.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, that Puritanism is something for them, that's something there for them to fall into.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still there. That Puritanism and that misogyny and that intense need to control women and blame them for their own lack of control. It's scary, and I'm hoping this, I don't know how, but I'm hoping it goes away.
And I don't think it will, but it just is what it is. I think it's just another wave we're going through, unfortunately. And you've got the whole, you know, give them a participation ribbon issue in with that, because, you know, if there's no competition, there's no reason to try. So a lot of these guys are not coming out of their basements because what's the point in trying? I'm just going to get, you know, shot down by a woman anyways. And then that's what starts building up this rage.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm still thinking a lot about it. I'm worried. Like, I have a nephew who's 13, and I know his parents are raising him right, and that he would not fall in for this. But, you know, I do worry about, I'll be a bit, maybe it's my age showing, but I do worry about kids these days. But I'm also like, you know, I think that there's some seriously a lot of guys, so I kind of like fell through the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
That I think there's guys who like, you know, like I was reading Andrea Nagel's book, Kill All Normies, and about the incels and that kind of movement. And it's like so much of these seems to be these guys who are like just so out of it, who have no, like, there's some like brief, there was like a brief moment when inceldom, when the idea of being an incel was about mutual support, was about commiseration, was about like resocialization and mutual help. And that did not last. And that now it's fallen so hard to, it's just this toxic misogyny and hatred and
that's what I was
going to
say. It goes into that rage that you have that boiling underneath. It's scary.
Yeah, and I feel bad for these guys who have just like fallen through the cracks, don't know, you know, and apparently, you know, need to be told, like, what went wrong with your life that you need to be told you have to shower every day? Like,
they give up.
Yeah, I just like I don't know if they're depressed. I don't know if they're this is some kind of undiagnosed mental illness. I don't know if this is like, the product of unemployment or what. If it's getting worse or better. If it's, this is just like a very violent a very loud minority that. But it's still like, geez, I feel so sad. This is like, I grew up on the first generation of the internet. This was like, mm-hmm. Where there was this dream that it would be the place where the soul, where the spirit ruled and where people would communicate, idea to idea. And instead it's producing like this horrible, it's producing this, all this toxic misogyny and racism and anti-liberalism, and it's just like, this is what sucks about getting old, is that you see the revolutions that gave you hope fail.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. And I mean, what do you, you can't fix it. You can't fix any of it. So you got to just keep treading water and moving through, and hopefully there's some light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm torn between like just wanting to beat these guys with a 2x4 and give them a hug.
Mm-hmm.
As weird as that sounds. So.
No, that doesn't. I get it. You just feel like you want to pound them one to just try and get through to them. And
yeah.
Then you also kind of want to go, it's all going
to
be okay.
I like
because they don't feel
that. I like to think that most of them are going to outgrow it. I like that are going to at some point get out of their basement, and get into the real world and stop obsessing over their maxillary width or whatever it is they're obsessing about.
Mm-hmm. It would be nice, but
yeah.
I don't know. I think we're in very weird times right now. We're in very changing
yeah.
times. So it's literally, like I said, it's treading water right now just to try and see what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's around the next corner, and we are being ricocheted through so many different things right now. It's
yeah.
crazy, and I think that doesn't help with a lot of mental health issues, too.
You see, this is why when you said we're a puritanical culture, it's not. I think that it's much more complicated than that. I think there's a puritanical strain. It's
right.
one of the vectors on society right now, but it's not. It's not only things, because it's like, the guys who are like making the incel culture are not old-fashioned Puritans. They're not puritanical, and they actually don't absorb the ideas of sobriety or hard work and things like that or modesty. They're much more invested. It's much more sort of variable. It's much more that's why I think people are trying to push Trumpism. Trump is not a conventional conservative in any way.
He was always a centrist.
Yeah. Well, I don't even think it's that. I think that whole vocabulary doesn't really apply anymore. Like trying to call him a liberal or a centrist or a conservative is not. It's the wrong vocabulary. He's not. He figured out a way to adapt his brand to a market, and that market happens to care about certain things that Trump himself, I'm pretty sure, doesn't give a damn about. But
mm-hmm.
he'll play to that base. He figured out that, there are these people who are really anxious about immigrants. They're really anxious about what their country's going to look like in a few years. They're very anxious about the idea of leftists and women. They're not at all and he figured, okay, we mobilize that, we keep pace with Steve Bannon and these alt-right types,
mm-hmm.
and that's and he pulled together this that this coalition that is, you know, it's certainly not liberal, but it's definitely not, certainly not the old-fashioned definition of conservative. This is a much, you know, meaner and harder and nastier breed, I think. And it's,
yeah,
they certainly don't care anything about, they don't care anything about old guard manners. They don't, never been to a country club. They've never been to that kind of stuff. That's the, I think we're viewing a sort of a new political system emerging right now that can't really be discussed in the same vocabulary.
You know what, you're right. It's almost not able to be put into words because it's so fluid. It's changing so fast, and you're right. It doesn't sit within anything that really was classically conservative. It's certainly not sitting anywhere in the realms of anything liberal. But you're absolutely right. Trump is only playing for his base. Mm-hmm. And if that's what can get him what he wants, that's what he'll do, is he will play to his base and he will tell them whatever it is he figures they want to hear. Doesn't mean he's buying into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Trump's been around. Trump figured out a long time ago that racism is the way to, you know, motivate people and attract people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, back with the Central Park Five, you know, he took out full page ads in them, in the New York Times about that, and you know, and that's, he's been bang, you know, that's, I think, is his. That's what I think he's been pushing at. And so it's not, but he doesn't, you know, he doesn't care about, you know, he doesn't care about classical conservative institutions. He doesn't care about museums or anything.
Oh, God, no, no. He only cares about himself.
So that's like, do we need, and I think to fight that, we need to come up with people who are much more, we need to come up with a sort of a new counter politics and a new way of somehow run Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders through the teleporter and merge them together
in a perfect world, Peter.
Yeah, but it's definitely something. I think things are changing. We got to put it together, and we got to stop playing by the old rule book.
Because there's no one playing by that rule book anymore.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Yeah, so
I really appreciate you being on the show tonight. Let everybody know, what website can they go to find out more? Obviously, we're going to have everything on our site, but where can they go to find and read your blog? Read more about this.
Historyofbdsm.com. That's my blog. You can also go to aloverspinch.com. That goes straight to the page, and that's where you can order it. That's where you can get it is available for sale on Amazon right now, not yet on Amazon.ca. And so it won't be in most mainstream bookstores. It's mostly going to be in university bookstores. So probably ordering online is going to be the best way to get it. And let's see. So I'm also on History of BDSM on Twitter, and also on Tumblr. And if you search on Facebook, History of BDSM, you'll find that as well. You know, if you want to drop a note or ask me a question, please do. I'd be glad to talk. And, you know, hot tips are welcome as well.
Yeah, you betcha.
Yeah. And so, this has been a long, many years of work coming together, but it's like, something I want to put out and give to, you know, I want to show, I think this would be, I want to give something to the world, and I want to give this to, like, something that I feel that this is a something missing in the world. This is the book I would have loved to have read, and I had to write it. And
we're glad that you
did,
because it's good.
And I hope that this, thank you. I hope that this can make a difference to people's worlds, the way, like, you know, reading art, reading Different Loving or the Leather Folk made a difference to me back in the 90s.
And you, I have no doubt that this book is going to reach someone. I'm sure many, but someone, just like it, just like those books reached you. So thank you very much, Peter. I really appreciate you being on the show. And so we will definitely make sure that there are links up so that you guys can get the book. Definitely get the book. The links are up there.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Peter. We appreciate you being here.
Okay. And thank you. It's been fun.
Bye now. I want to thank my guest tonight, Peter Tupper, for sharing his wisdom. You guys, seriously, this book is so intense and so, like, not intense, but it's so juicy. It's so juicy. It has so much info in it, and it's so cool. So I want you guys to pick up this book. And I think for anyone wanting to learn the craft, anyone entering into this as a business, or you're just starting out, get this book. Because if you're going to learn about something, learn about the history of it first. Do your research, just like Peter did. And actually, he's done it for you. So if you want to learn more, and I suggest that you do, definitely go to In Bed with Dr. Sue. You're going to find links right there. You can just click on Peter's book, and it will take you straight to Amazon. I want to say, if you get a chance, by the way, be sure to head to Kinky Magazine for a ton of really valuable information and insights into the BDSM and fetish world, with writers like Kimmy Kaboom giving you the latest from the BBW world, new writers like Mistress Kai, who just did an awesome article on alpha subs, plus yours truly, who just did an article called Cuckolding, Is Cuckolding Being Twisted? And I can assure you that it is. To read all these amazing articles and interviews, you head to KinkEMag, it's kink, the letter E, mag.com. And on the next In Bed with Dr. Sue, on Tuesday, August the 14th at 10 p.m., you'll be getting little old me and nothing more. Mama Bear's pissed, so I'm taking over the airwaves again. I'm about to spill the tea. First off, this is the first one. There's going to be more on the cuckold community. Not on cuckolding. There's going to be more that are going to cause a lot of people to get pretty pissy when I start doing these shows, because I am calling everyone out. I am tired of the crap I'm seeing online, and everybody's going to get spanked, and it's not going to feel good. I expect you guys to call in when I'm doing these shows. If I say something that you don't agree with, call in. Debate me. That's what this is for. It's not just for me to sit here and sound off. This is for you guys to do as well. That's what the show is for. Call in, give me, you know, debate me. Like I said, I don't have a problem with that. I'm going to be teaching that night what cuckolding is, and more importantly, what cuckolding isn't, in Cuckolding in 2018, Lies Uncovered. The other thing is, hit up the drsuereview.com for all my latest articles, including the recent Dom differences, where I explain what each type of Dom is and why they all hate each other. And, of course, for all of the episodes of In Bed with Dr. Sue, you can go to inbedwithdrsue.com, or, of course, they're on iTunes. So until next time, you guys, remember, as long as you're breathing, it's a good day. So try to make it a happy one. Just remember, that's all that matters, is whether you're happy. I'll see you on the flip side, guys.